Hello, my name is Mish Levy, and I am grateful to have the opportunity to present to you here a discussion on the history and practice of an idea shaping one of the key conflicts in the world today. The Native American activist and poet John Trudell once said that he felt he was living in a place where most people used words without understanding what the words meant, and therefore that the people using them didn't understand what they themselves meant. This lack of understanding renders us unable to act meaningfully, or, at the very least, shapes our actions in less meaningful ways. One of the concepts and words at the heart of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is Zionism. Stop and think for a moment about what Zionism means. If you can describe it in a couple of sentences, then you have telescoped centuries of history into a single moment. In that act of caricature, most of the important insights about the forces that word represents are lost. In this two-part series called The History of Zionism and the Zionist Left Today, we hope to deepen your understanding of the term and the various strains of meaning and history contained within it. In this two-part series called The History of Zionism and the Zionist Left Today, we hope to deepen your understanding of the term and the various strains of meaning and history contained within it. It's also our hope that this discussion will broaden your own understanding of politics and political forces more generally, particularly the roots and fruit of a variety of forms of nationalism. We hope you find these programs of value in expanding the dialogue on Zionism and its role in contemporary politics. These two programs on Zionism feature interviews and discussion with Dr. Barry Trachtenberg. Barry is a longtime student of the role of the Yiddish language in early Jewish national movements, as well as on the moral questions of resistance and rescue during the Nazi Holocaust. He has a master's degree in history from the University of Vermont and a PhD in modern Jewish history from UCLA. Over the last 9 years, he has also studied in New York, Berlin, Jerusalem, and Oxford. He is presently an assistant professor of modern Jewish history at SUNY Albany. I'm honored that he could join me and that we can share this conversation with you.
Barry, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The term Zionism tends to get used based on assumptions of what we think it means or how meaning has been made of it over time, but the word is rarely defined or contextualized. I'd like to ask you, Barry, if you had to define Zionism in a sentence, what would you say?
I'd say that Zionism is the name of the Jewish national movement that began in the late 19th century with the intention of liberating the Jews from what its proponents believe to be the wholly negative consequence of the Jews' unnatural state of exile and dispersion.
Wow.
There's a lot of pieces to that.
There's a lot of pieces to that. Ultimately, what you've done, though, is describe a political project. This is a national liberation movement that you're describing, and we can go back and look at those other pieces, but I'm wondering if you make distinctions between political Zionism, as you've just described, or ideological Zionism, religious Zionism.
I'm not sure if it was wholly a political movement, however. I think it had many political components to it, and for many of its advocates, it was a political agenda that they had with the goal of creating a Jewish state somewhere, ideally in Palestine. But for many others, it was a cultural project, and for some, it was indeed even a religious project. And so it has all these different components to it that hopefully we'll be able to explore through the course of our conversation.
Thank you. I'm also wondering, when we're talking about this term, do you have thoughts about how the word Zionism gets misused or misconstrued in daily contemporary usage?
Yeah, I think it's both by its advocates and its opponents. Zionism today is often equated with Judaism, and so that Jews are unanimously seen as Zionists, often by Zionists and by opponents of Zionism. And so I think it's important to understand that Zionism is one trend in modern Jewish thought. It understands Judaism to be a nationality primarily, and that all other aspects of Judaism are really subordinate to the national identity. So culturally, linguistically, religiously, all those things are subordinate to the idea that Jews are a national group.
The development of Zionist thought is integral to European history. We often tend to relate the roots of Zionism to, I think, the Holocaust, to World War II, when in fact the roots of Zionism are embedded in a time period significantly before that. When we talk about the origins of Zionist thought, what time period are we referring to?
We're talking about the final decades of the 19th century.
What was the environment that Jews were responding to and mm-hmm. that Zionism was an outgrowth of?
Sure. You have in the late 1880s, in Russia in particular, where the most adherents of Zionism really came from, it's a time of dramatic modernization. You have Russia fighting a war with Japan during this time period. It's trying to modernize its society and industrialize society. And yet, unlike in Central Europe and in Western Europe, this process of industrialization only further to bankrupt Russia's society further. The Tsar is under increasing pressure to liberalize its society by a small but powerful growing middle class. It's being challenged by an entrenched conservative nobility that's resisting all of these changes. You have a very powerful growing labor movement in Russia at this time period. And perhaps the most potent force of all are these new national movements that are emerging among the different minority groups within the Russian Empire, in particular Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, Belarusia, as well as Estonia, Latvia. And Jewish nationalism is one of these many different national movements that begins in the final decades of the 19th century as a result of all of these radical changes and shifts that are occurring within Russian society. In Western Europe and in Central Europe, you have in the 1880s, 1890s, this scramble for colonization, especially for Africa. Germany, which is only unified in the early 1870s, is radically modernizing and industrializing its economy, militarizing it as well. And you have all of these different national groups, these different states, competing for power and really engaging this whole land grab. There's the carving up of Africa. There's excursions into Asia, into South America, the scramble for resources. These tensions ultimately culminate in 1914 with the war. But you have a very big contrast between what's happening in the East and what's happening in the West, in that the forces of modernization are in many ways enriching the societies in the West, but depleting the resources of the ones in the East. Countries like Britain, France, and Germany are really growing into very, very powerful economic forces on the global stage, whereas Russia is really in this state of decline. It's just further weakening and further sort of crumbling apart.
What kind of influence is that happening on the economic circumstances for people in those countries at that time?
Well, it means that in the West, on the whole, despite the fact that there's some depressions, there's a depression of the 1870s, and you have one in the 1890s, but these economies are rapidly modernizing, and so you're seeing the growth of a very powerful class system. You're seeing a labor movement that's really beginning to develop, and you're seeing a very, very strong liberal-minded middle class that's developing.
Can you say something about how this period of modernization is influencing intellectual thought at the time?
You see the rise of sort of three dominant forms of intellectual thought. One is liberalism, which really focuses on the individual's rational capacity for self-promotion. And, you know, it really rests on this theory that people are individuals and they'll make decisions based upon their own self-interests. And that is the best organizing model for society. And it leads to liberal forms of capitalism, liberal forms of socialism, liberal forms of nationalism and whatnot.
Liberal forms of democracy.
Liberal forms of democracy as well. At the same time that you have liberalism emerging, which is largely an outgrowth of the creation of this middle class, you also have the development of socialism and Marxism, which, while they're not the same, we can sort of look at them as one larger phenomenon, which really speaks to the needs of this new industrialized labor force that's really coming to the fore and producing all of this wealth. And at the same time that is going on, you have this third strand of nationalism where many people are identifying themselves as members not of a class or not of individuals, but as part of a particular nation, so that they are Germans based upon their German race or their German language or the fact that they come from German soil, and the same with, you know, Poles or Ukrainians or Russians or whatnot. And these three forces are really vying for power and authority. And you have variants of all of them. So, you know, like I said, you have socialist nationalism and socialist forms of liberalism and things like this. And the Jews, like all other groups, are buying into these ideologies, helping to shape them and apply them to their own particular causes and interests.
I would also like to ask you what you think the influence of German nationalism was on the way nationalism was conceived during the period, what kind of motivational influences it might have had, or definitive influences on what type of nationalism we're talking about.
Yeah. With the Enlightenment, so if we can even step back almost a century before, you have really two dominant trends of nationalism that develop. And one way to look at it, sort of in maybe a little too simplified way, but it's to look at different models produced by the French and by the Germans. And the Germans, the French came out with a model that was universalistic. And it's basically said that anyone can become French as long as you agree to a certain set of principles of, you know, liberty, equality, fraternity, etc. But there's also this shadow dark side to it, which ultimately led to the fact that anyone must become French if you're in French society. And we can even still see these battles being played out today, where you have the case of Muslim schoolgirls who are being forced to take off their scarves because it's somehow not French and they're not buying into this notion of what it means to be French. But there's something fundamentally coercively democratic about the French model. By a real contrast to it, the German model that got its start by the philosopher Herder, he argued that nationalism was not based upon adherence to a set of principles, but it came out of a shared biology, a shared language, and a shared commitment to a piece of land. And that is what delineated the borders of different national groups. So you were a member of the German nation. If your mother tongue was German, if you're from German lands, if you understood yourself as being part of this larger German race. And from Germany to points eastward, so to include the lands of Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, and the whole Russian Empire, you have this model of nationalism really developing. And this is the model that largely the Jews buy into in both the East and the West. And so Jews are identifying themselves as, or those Jews who adopt this national model, adopt not the model of the French, but the model of the Germans, where they see themselves as being Jewish because they come from a historic land of Eretz Yisrael or Palestine, that they share a common tongue, whether that be Hebrew or Yiddish, at least it's an ancestral tongue, that they're part of this biological group, which is the Jewish national body.
So it's connected. What I'd like to do is get a better understanding of how these nationalist movements have come to their fruition at this time period. What is the time period? What's going on that's driving these nationalist forces?
The Russian Empire was one of the major empires that really defined geopolitics in the 17th and 18th centuries. You also have the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, Prussia, and the world is divided into these very large empires. Russia was perhaps the largest of all of these. It was absolutely vast, something like 8.5 million square miles. It stretched all the way to the Far East, bordering with China. But it also included parts of Poland, which had been divided in the 18th century. So it had Polish lands, it had Ukrainian lands, it had Belarusian lands, Estonian, Latvian. So all these different population groups are part of this much larger Russian body, and including millions of Jews as well, who were scattered throughout the western portions in a region that they're confined to legally called the Pale of Jewish Settlement, which is an area about the size equivalent of France. So it's really quite large. And it's all of these different all these different ethnic groups begin to take on national identities in the second half of the 19th century. For several different reasons. One is that nationalism is just one of these very large currents that's making its way throughout Europe as an ideology of liberation, to freeing up different groups and to allow them to differentiate themselves from one another. But in the case of the empires, and in particular the Russian Empire, it really becomes this ideology of liberation from Russian rule. That Russia has this policy that it's been trying to put forth for almost its entire existence of one Russia, where it seeks to Russify all of the different populations within its midst, getting them to embrace Russian culture, to the Russian language, Russian dress, Russian ways of worship. The goal of this is to have them just remain with just little scraps of their ethnic identity as kind of interesting folkloric curiosities. And so there's enormous resistance to this policy, especially because it's often conducted with brutal force. So in the Ukraine and in Poland, for example, anytime there are stirrings of really kind of a cultural rebirth or cultural renaissance, they're put down often with severe force. So in the case of the Ukrainians, for example, They're in the 1860s and 70s. Their presses are censored. It's illegal to publish in the Ukrainian language because it's really the goal of Russia to turn the Ukrainians and the Poles and the Finns and all these different groups into Russians.
If we let that be the kind of bigger picture that this conversation is set in, I'd like to then discuss Zionism as actually only one of the very diverse responses that came from Jewish communities at this time period in terms of their relationship to nationalism, to all of the issues we've been discussing. Can you speak to some of that diversity? And
There are many, many different responses to modernity by the Jews. Nationalism is one of them. And nationalism itself has many, many currents. One of those currents is the political Zionism that ultimately led to the state. I'll try to give you something of an overview of these different responses. The rise of the new economic systems and structures, especially among Russian Jews, led to their great impoverishment. Many Jews were forced out of their role of being sort of small business owners or artisans, being in sort of specialty occupations, and were forced to join sort of this larger proletariat, as many of them understood it, now moving into urban centers and forced to work in factories as a way to make a living and sort of forced into a greater state of destitution. It's the rise of the sweatshop, and Jews are part of this whole system. The choice of many Jews, indeed perhaps most Jews who were able to make a choice, was to leave. And most people who had the option went to the United States, and you have millions of Jews making their way from Russia from 1880 to 1914 coming to the United States, motivated primarily by economic means, but also because of new waves of oppression and anti-Semitism that are really raging throughout Russia from 1880 in fits and starts through 1917. You have major pogroms in 1881. You have another wave of pogroms in 1903, 1905, and then finally with the rise of World War I. And so Jews are constantly fleeing because of that. So the first choice of many Jews is to leave. The second is to join labor movements. And you have the rise in the 1890s of different worker groups that are starting to emerge. The strongest of these is founded in 1897, known as the Bund, the Jewish Labor Union. And for a time, it's actually the largest labor movement within Russia, Jewish or otherwise. Other Jews stick to the liberal path that had been an outgrowth of the Jewish Enlightenment, which had the ideology that if Jews sought to modernize themselves and educate themselves in modern ways as opposed to in religious ways, they would then sort of be accepted into the larger Russian society. And so you have a small but powerful and influential group of Jews who have really joined the middle class and indeed even the upper class of Russian society. At the same time, you have Jews who are just trying to keep their heads down and live their lives in the traditional religious ways that they had, or at least they understood themselves to be living for centuries. And then you have groups of Jews who seek to start organizing around national lines. And this leads us to a larger conversation about Zionism. And you see Jews starting to move from this ideology of emancipation, which is in many ways the hallmark of the Enlightenment, that Jews could be emancipated if they adopt the values of the Enlightenment.
When you use the term Enlightenment there, are you talking about the Jewish Enlightenment in particular?
Talking about the larger Enlightenment, of which the Jewish Enlightenment was a part, that the bargain that was struck with the Jewish Enlightenment was that if Jews were to drop their ways that made them particular, that they would be accepted into the larger society. So this was largely a very successful project in Germany, for example, or in France, where Jews dropped their distinctive ways of dress. They dropped their distinctive language. They stopped speaking Yiddish and they would speak German, for example, if they were in German territories. They moved from religiously oriented careers into the new professions of law or business or administration, things like this. And in return, what they hoped for was emancipation and acceptance as full citizens in society. This was gained by the Jews soon after the French Revolution in France, and then in Germany it took much longer, nearly a century longer. It wasn't until the 1870s that Jews were fully emancipated into German society. In Russia, you also have a similar trend a much smaller group of Jews who are also part of this desire to enter into this bargain that if they took on Russian identity as their primary identity, that they would be accepted as Jews. And this is really this ideology of emancipation. What happens, though, is that starting in the final decades of the 19th century, there's a new wave of anti-Semitism that begins to emerge, and indeed it's the creation of modern anti-Semitism as we know, and the invention of the term in the 1870s and 80s, both in Russia, in France, in Germany. And you start seeing Jews move from this notion of emancipation, which is really dependent on their host societies, to auto-emancipation. This notion that Jews need to emancipate themselves and liberate themselves from both their host societies that are oppressing them in some ways, but also from their old ways and their old traditional ways. So it's this distancing themselves from their religiosity, from these out-of-date professions, often from these languages that no longer seem to be viable ways of communicating modern thought and modern ideas, and to start rallying around this idea that they were a national group that needed to determine the course of its own destiny.
There isn't one form of Jewish nationalism. There are many, many forms of Jewish nationalism that were emerging at this time. Is that, how would you...
Absolutely, yeah. You have political Zionism that's best represented by Theodor Herzl, who's perhaps the most well-known figure of Zionism, who in 1897 has the first Zionist Congress, which is held in Basel, Switzerland. And the goal of his strand of Zionism is to use diplomacy to forge a Jewish state somewhere, ideally Palestine, but not necessarily the region of Palestine. And his vision of a Jewish state was that Jews would primarily create a state that resembled the European societies in which he grew up, in which he lives, for example, Austria, Czechoslovakia, France, Germany, etc. And they would form that sort of state where Jews were fully part of the middle class, and yet fulfilling all the functions of the creation of a full state. But that's just one strand. Other strands of Zionism included cultural Zionism, and indeed Herzl's greatest opponent was someone named Echad Ha'am, meaning one of the people. It was the pen name of someone named Asher Ginsberg. And he said the project of Zionism should not be the creation of a Jewish state, but it needs to be a cultural renaissance and reawakening of the Jewish people, that their experience in exile and their confrontation with the modern world has led to this great distancing between where they are now and the culture from which they come. So he advocated a return to Hebrew, for example, away from the Yiddish language that most of them spoke. He saw that Zionism would be a bulwark against this Russification that was the policy of the Russian government. And he hoped for a real cultural renaissance and spiritual renaissance of the Jewish people. At the same time, you have religious forms of Zionism that have some start at this time period, but really begin to flourish in the 20s and 30s. And you also have this, perhaps the strongest component is a form of socialist Zionism that really has its roots long before Herzl, perhaps as much as two decades before Herzl, where you have Jews who are trying to come up with something of a synthesis between the apparently mutually opposing ideologies of socialism and nationalism. Socialism, on the one hand, is universalistic. It doesn't pay attention to racial borders or national borders or indeed gender borders in its best form, but is concerned with all workers and it understands itself organized along class lines. Nationalism, on the other hand, is a particularistic ideology. It doesn't pay attention to class. It simply pays attention to if you're a member of this particular nation, the nation is the primary organizing principle. But there are figures who, beginning in the 1880s, 1890s, who had been part of different socialist movements in Russian society, but largely in response to the increasing waves of anti-Semitism, sought to apply some of these models to the particular case of the Jews. And so you start seeing waves of emigration out of Russia not just to the United States for economic reasons, where people essentially leave just to try to build a better life, but you see the attempt of new Jewish colonies or collectives or settlements in different parts of the world. The ones that last the longest are the ones that ultimately led to the State of Israel. However, you have ones that come to the United States. You have Jews, for example, looking at the experience of the Mormons in Utah and seeing how well they did, creating a new society. And so you have Jews making their way to the West, to Oregon, for example, and they create a community called New Odessa. You have other Jews making their way to Argentina to possibly establish new Jewish societies there where they could live along socialist principles, but take care of Jewish interests. Like I said, the most effective one of these was the ones that ultimately led to the creation of the Jewish state in Palestine, but it was just one of many strands that really began in the final decades of the 19th century in Russia.
In general, liberation movements tend to be illegal.
Yeah.
There are many national movements going on at that time in history. Presumably, they were illegal. Zionist organizing was originally illegal. Is that so?
No, not. So not in Russia, anyways, where the bulk of the Jews actually existed. And not even to an extent in Germany and in France. Russia had wavering policies towards the Jews. And in many ways, since the 1880s, they were doing everything they could to encourage Jews to leave Russia as the solution to the Jewish question. So by encouraging their emigration somewhere out of the empire was really in the interests of the authorities. And so they didn't necessarily give financial assistance to these early sort of proto-Zionist movements like Chibat Zion or Hove Zion, but they did permit them to organize and operate within the empire. However, after 1903, 1905, where there are more and more attempts at an actual revolution within Russian society, these organizations, which all of them shift leftward to taking on more and more revolutionary ideologies themselves, begin to be banned by the state. And so on the eve of the Russian Revolution of 1917, it's illegal to be publishing in Hebrew and Yiddish again the way it had been earlier. But for a long time, these activities were permitted because it meant the Jews were leaving.
Thank you. I'd like to jump ahead now to about the 1930s.
Well, okay.
Yeah. Life has changed dramatically in Europe. Can you paint us a new picture of sorts? Can you paint us a new picture? Can you give us a sense of what's going on at the time and in what context the Zionist movement finds itself now?
Yeah, so let's look at three different groups quickly. The first is now the Soviet Union, where Zionism is banned by the state, and there is a substantial Jewish population of several million Jews who have the right to cultural and national development within Soviet society, but only in a Soviet way. And so you have the creation, for example, of a whole Yiddish school system, Yiddish language academies, higher education institutes, Yiddish theater, Yiddish newspapers, but they all have to adhere to the Soviet line. And so interestingly enough, in the early 1920s, you have many Jews making their way to the Soviet Union because they see that they're going to have a state-sponsored Yiddish culture, most of them not knowing what the later consequences would be. After World War II, you have the creation of an independent Polish state, which is really the inheritors in many ways of the great Jewish societies that existed in the Russian Empire before the war. And you have 3 million Jews in Poland at this time. With the signing of the Treaty of Versailles, Poland, as one of the terms for its actual creation, was required to sign a minorities treaty respecting the rights of the various minorities within its society. And so many Jews are actually very excited by this because they see they too will get state sponsorship. However, by the 1930s, it's very, very clear that Polish authorities have no interest whatsoever in promoting the minority interests of or the interests of these different national minorities. And in the 1930s, and especially by the late 1930s, you have a very, very potent movement of anti-Semitism within Poland. And so you have waves of Jews making their way out of Poland, coming to the United States in the early 1920s, and then once new immigration barriers pop up in the United States, you see new waves of immigration to Palestine and producing the third and the fourth Aliyot, the waves of immigration to Israel or to Palestine. Then in Germany, the 20s were very good for the Jews under the Weimar regime, which was a liberal democracy in which many Jews really flourished. By the late 1920s, early 30s, you have the rise of Nazism, and anti-Semitism becomes state policy. The Jews lose the emancipation that they gained in 1870, so they're no longer citizens. And it's the policy of the German government is to get rid of the Jews as quickly as possible by pushing them out of the country, and many Jews make their way to Palestine as a result.
I'm wondering if we can speak for a minute about the European responses to Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
What were those responses? Were they political? Were they strategic? Were they anti-Semitic? What kinds of responses are coming from France, Germany, Britain, and why?
The largest response is probably a non-response, that the Jews are tiny minorities in these countries, and so largely the societies are uninterested in the internal struggles within the Jewish community. So, it's not really in their interest to pay attention to what's happening in these sort of intramural wars that are going on in Jewish ideological circles. However, the national movement of Zionism in Palestine is actually quite important in terms of British designs on the territory. So now we're in the period between the two world wars when Britain is the colonial occupier of Palestine, taking it over from the Ottomans. And their interest is twofold in terms of the relationship between Jews and Arabs there. One is to make it as trouble-free as possible, and so do anything they can so that there won't be conflicts between the Jews and the Arab populations. And so if that means supporting Jewish aspirations for independence, they'll do so. So, for example, with the Balfour Declaration, where
1917,
where the British government said very clearly that it supported the idea of a Jewish state, and yet later on it was in Britain's interest to come out in support of the side of the Arabs, whose national identity began to really emerge in this time period as Palestinians, and their strength also had begun to develop in terms of resisting the colonialism of both the Jews and the British. So there are times where they're going to make concessions to the Palestinian side and therefore try to restrict Jewish immigration to the land.
What about France at the time?
Driving many of the British concerns also is trying to check French aspirations on the region. France is in Egypt, France is in the Sinai. And so by having a strong, stable society there, it's a way of checking French power. You also have France in Syria, I believe, at this time period. So there's this real competition for power at this time period. So by having a stable, secure society in Palestine, it's a way of stopping French incursions.
One of the results of World War I was the carving up of the Middle East by the European powers at the time and the moving in of the European powers into the Middle East as a colonial project. Is that correct?
It's not the beginning of that. You see an acceleration of that. I mean, Napoleon had made his way to Egypt, more than 200 years before then. So there's always been an interest in that region because it's filled with resources and it's filled with religious history that's very, very important to Christian Europe. And so, it's always been an interest, but you see this accelerated throughout this time period, in large part because of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire.
Do you see any incentive by European countries to have Jews migrate to Palestine in order to remove them so that there are smaller Jewish populations in Europe?
Yeah, you see that in two cases. One, you see that in Germany in the 1930s, that it's really in their interest to push Jews out. And so if they can push the Jews to Palestine, that's fine. If they can push them elsewhere, that's also fine. What you find, of course, is that most nations of the world really threw up walls that prohibited Jews from entering. So many Jews were stuck in Europe and couldn't leave. And then you also see it, like I had said earlier, you see it in Russia in the 1880s, 1890s, where it's in their interest to also encourage Jews to leave as a way of settling their Jewish problem. And so they're going to allow for Zionist activity and Zionist organizing and fundraising to take place within the empire until they deem it becomes a threat, really, at the turn of the century as there are growing waves of revolutionary activity. And so they put a stop to Zionism as much as they can at that time period.
And my last question on this topic is the incentive of the British to have a Jewish outpost, perhaps, in the region of the Middle East at the time. And we're talking post-World War I.
Yeah, yeah. The Jews are seen as a Europeanizing force in many ways to the British when they're looked upon favorably. Like, that is what can work in British interests, that they come from Europe, so they bring European sensibilities. They bring a European sense of democracy, of government. Primarily, they bring a European sense of economy with them, and that they can create a more capitalistic society and really serve as the foundation for a more European society in the Middle East, which will help facilitate British interests. At the same time, though, I want to be mindful that the Jewish leaders and the Zionist leaders in Israel are also trying to play the British as much as the British are trying to play them. And they're trying to work on the national stage and force Britain and France and different powers to compete for Jewish interests as well. And so you have all these groups vying for power. Because I want to get away from the fact that the Jews were simply just a tool of the British, that they were really trying to use one another as much as possible, which makes sense in any kind of battle, that people try to manipulate the outcome as best they can to their own advantage.
You're talking about a set of political strategies and how different sets of political strategies are playing out in relation to each other. I'm wondering, how did we get from the diversity of Zionist thought that we've been discussing earlier to this point where there are political power centers that are able to make such strategic decisions?
Yeah, so we talked about how in the end of the 19th century you have all these different variants of Zionism. Some are thinking about creating a Jewish state somewhere in the world, perhaps Palestine, perhaps somewhere in Africa or in South America. You have other forms of Zionism that are religiously minded or at least culturally minded, and you have many forms of Jewish nationalism that aren't concerned with the state at all. They're just concerned with promoting Jewish minority rights in the lands in which the Jews find themselves, be that Russia, be that Poland, be that wherever. Zionism in the 1920s and in the 1930s was still a very, very minority strand in Jewish thought and in Jewish political activity. It was not the dominant strand. Certainly not among the Jews outside of the Yishuv, outside of Palestine. Most Jews were trying to join the middle classes of their societies or else were invested in the Jewish labor movement. You know, perhaps they were concerned with Yiddish culture or the new Hebrew culture that was emerging at the time period. But Zionism was just one of the many forces competing for power, or competing for the hearts and minds of the Jews. What happens is that I think that the political project becomes the one that's most viable and it becomes dominant because it can both serve the needs of Jewish workers as well as the Jewish middle class, that because it's not so defined along class lines, that more Jews can join in on it. At the same time, you have rising tides of anti-Semitism, which seem to cut off other options for a continued vibrant Jewish life in Europe. Certainly by the 1920s and 30s, you've had massive waves of pogroms that occurred in the aftermath of World War I in the Ukraine, where as many as 250,000 Jews perhaps were killed in 1919, 1920. You have growing instability in Germany in the 1920s, and then ultimately you have the rise, obviously, of the Nazis in the 1930s. In Poland, you have the best chance for an alternative Jewish life. And yet, by the 1930s, you start seeing waves and waves of anti-Semitism as well. And so most Jews are starting to focus their attention on leaving. And one of the dominant options for leaving, especially after the U.S. begins to close its borders in the mid-1920s, is to come to Palestine. And in time, that project becomes seen as the most viable alternative for many Jews. And you have, on the eve of World War I, now hundreds of thousands of Jews who have made their way to Palestine and indeed created cities, new towns, and have become the dominant group, not population-wise, but certainly in terms of power in the region.
If I understand you correctly, you're saying that people weren't looking for ideological movements anymore, that what was needed was a political project.
You raise a really important point here, is that from the very beginning, people saw that there were two different sets of motivations that brought people to Palestine. One was ideological, and these were the people who were typically in leadership positions, and perhaps the first waves of people who made their way to Palestine. But then you have other people who make their way there out of personal considerations. They're not concerned with the larger Jewish national body. They're not concerned primarily with a Jewish renaissance. They're concerned with their lives. They're concerned with their livelihoods. They're concerned with continuing to exist in a world that is increasingly unwilling to allow that to occur. You have these growing waves of migration to Palestine from Europe, from Poland, from Germany in the 1920s, then in the 1930s, and they're largely non-ideological waves of migrants. But the leadership of these different movements certainly tries to use their coming to further their ideological goals of creating a Jewish state. And yet there's great tension that sort of gets put into place in that the earlier settlers, the earlier colonialists to the land of Israel, are seen as more heroic, more brave, because they didn't come because they were hungry.
They had to.
That they came because they wanted to. And so there's something of a disdain for the later ways of migrants.
Let's look at the ways that political ideologies are brought over and used to influence the way that Israel was built.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about nation building, we're talking about a really strong labor movement.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other forces? How would you lay out the political forces there?
So if we can talk about the period before World War I for a second, and then I'll talk about the period after World War I where you have enough people there to actually make this vision a reality. Before World War I, you have people coming to Israel primarily out of ideological reasons, certainly in the 1880s, 1890s. Starting 1905 with the first Russian Revolution, you have another larger wave of migration, which is a mixture of motivation, some out of ideology, some out of consideration to save their lives. But largely these were very ideological people, which meant they were fairly poor workers. Many of them believed deeply in Jewish nationalism, believed deeply in ideas of Jewish socialism, but that's not enough to actually do the work to create a state. You know, and so they saw that part of their project had to be not only the movement of Jews from one part of the world to another, but like I said earlier, this real renaissance of being a Jew, this distancing from all the aspects of the diaspora. And indeed, one of the founding tenets of Zionism is something called Shlilat HaGolah, meaning the negation of exile. So all those aspects of the diaspora that they saw contributed to their inferior status, they needed to distance themselves from. So what that meant in economic terms was that Jews needed to leave their old occupations of either being engaged in study and in religious forms of labor, or being in something of a middle class, artisans, small business owners, towards working the land. And they saw that by working the land, they would renew themselves as a people, and that they could take this land that in their imagination was largely barren and largely unsettled and somehow have that be the land in which they would enrich themselves. However, when they arrived, and some certainly knew beforehand, many discovered that there was actually another group of people already occupying that land, of course, the Arabs. And so there becomes very quickly a competition that develops from the very early periods, well before World War I, between Jewish laborers and Arab laborers. So what you find is that Jewish laborers typically are less skilled at working. They don't have a long history of working the land. So they're less successful in creating new agricultural settlements. And soon they have to start selling their labor to larger Jewish landowners. And they, out of this struggle comes this notion of conquest through labor, and that the Jews are going to conquest the land through labor and also conquest themselves through labor. They're going to distance themselves from that diaspora mentality through labor. So what they start insisting is that Jewish landowners who are being sponsored by benefactors in Europe, such as the Rothschilds and others, who've been buying up tracts of land out of this national ideology, they start demanding that they only hire Jewish workers. Yet Jewish workers typically weren't as effective as Arab workers, and they wanted a higher rate of pay because they wanted to live European lives. The Arab agricultural workers who were there at the turn of the century were typically used to a different standard of living with a lower rate of pay and were willing to work for lower wages. And so you have this real struggle, and it's out of this struggle where Jews are not able to find work for themselves that you start seeing the creation of Jewish collectives and the Jewish kibbutzim. You know, we've heard this term about the Jewish kibbutz, which later becomes really the ideology of the founding of the state, but it was primarily out of practical considerations as an alternative to this idea that Jews could be sort of in charge of the land themselves. And it just was really a practical consideration as a way of remaining an economically viable force.
We've been talking a lot about how Zionism's major theorists and most of its original activists were invested in socialist and communist ideals, as were other national majority movements. What are you saying about what has happened to those leftist ideals upon arrival in Israel, or upon arrival in what was to become Israel, depending on what time period we're talking?
Yeah, so many of the Jews who first made their way to Israel were fully invested in Zionist and socialist ideals, that they thought there could be a combination of the two. What happens, though, time after time, is that the socialist ideals get sacrificed for the national cause, that ultimately this becomes a nationalist project, and that it's not about class consciousness, it's not about class warfare, it's not about reaching out to all workers. What they take from socialism is this idea that labor is who should be in charge, and that it's through labor that the society is going to be built. But they're not opposed to the middle class. They're not opposed even to the wealthy classes of Jews if they're using their resources towards the creation of a Jewish state or towards the creation of the Zionist project. When they're opposed to middle-class Jews and wealthy Jews, it's when they're, for example, not hiring Jews as their labor force, because that's somehow seen as a betrayal of Jewish national interest, and they'll attack them on class lines for that. But if they're investing their money and their time and their resources, they're perfectly willing to allow them to make a profit off of their labor. So it's really not about socialism ultimately, but they keep this ideology of socialism as one that's sort of bandied about. What they really mean is the notion of the primacy of labor as the agency for the creation of a new state.
Yeah, that's very well put. Whether it's conscious or not, there's a construction of the meaning of socialism.
Absolutely.
That serves to promote a Jewish state.
I would say that certainly by the 1920s, 1930s, it's a very conscious reconstruction of the ideology of socialism to put towards the Zionist project, because that's when you start having real, real major conflicts between Jewish laborers and Palestinian laborers for power. And they'll use this ideology of socialism and yet be trying to suppress Arab workers and suppress them, although supposedly they're members of the same economic class.
I've heard you use the terms a labor movement of the Jews, the worker working for the nation, socialism for the Jews. These are ways of trying to understand the contradictions that are built into the definition of socialism used for these very specific purposes. Here, I'm going to ask you a question that I've heard you ask that I think is very useful. These discrepancies between a socialist ideal and how socialism is manifesting in Palestine and then in Israel, how are we to explain them? Either today's left is a betrayal of the ideas on which it was founded, or those ideas were flawed from the very beginning, or there are fundamental contradictions built into this liberation movement.
I think it's probably some of each, if I can take that viewpoint. From the very beginning, you have that many leaders of both the Yishuv and then later the state who see themselves as both socialists and nationalists. And I think many believe that. And they see that as a real source of their strength and a source of their ways of being progressive, politically progressive. Their actions, I think, are really quite different from their ideology. And what ultimately they settle on is a socialism for the Jews. And that socialism is confined to the Jews. And that, in many ways, becomes sort of the dominant motif of both the Jewish settlement in Palestine and then later the first several decades of the state, that there's concern with social welfare. There is concern with a Jewish labor movement. You have the Histadrut. And yet all of this is geared towards the building of the state. It's not towards the building of the class. And what gets sacrificed from that, of course, is the indigenous population, that they're not included in this definition. And so they're shunted aside, first by economic realities on the ground, and then later by state policy, that they become excluded. And so when you talk about the left today in Israel, who is in some ways the inheritors of this long tradition of Jewish socialism, their primary concern, and whenever their back is up against the wall, is to privilege the nation over the universal.
How do those contradictions get explained?
They get explained in different ways. One is that they're often not acknowledged. Two is that socialism starts getting talked about less and less by people like David Ben-Gurion as opposed to labor. So labor becomes discussed more and more as a goal, a vision, as something to be triumphed, and less socialism. And then lastly is to shift much of the responsibility onto the Arabs and Palestinians for not joining along in this new vision of the society and the realm that the Jews who are increasingly becoming in power are putting forth. And so they'll blame the Arabs for taking away Jewish jobs, for example, as opposed to blame themselves and see how they're an economic force is taking away Arab jobs. Later, they'll talk about different ways that they've tried to reach out to the Arabs but were met by violence and things like that, never truly trying to understand the situation for the Arab population, or if they do truly understand it, to say that that is simply just a necessary evil for this greater good that they understood themselves to be working for. At the worst end of this, you have people who simply say, we need to jettison the socialist ideologies entirely in favor of more capitalist ones, in favor of more liberal ones, and put down by force the Arab population if they're going to oppose us in our project.
Okay, well, here seems like a logical place to return to a topic that we skipped over a moment ago, which is we've been discussing quite extensively the Zionist left. Mm-hmm. We haven't talked distinctly about a Zionist right.
You have, for example, the rise of Vladimir Jabotinsky, who, like most of the founders of the state, is born in the 1880s, who is a player in the Russian Revolution in 1905 in different Jewish communities, although he takes actually a quite moderate liberal stance, and becomes radicalized in his 1930s and 40s in the years between the two world wars, and develops this other form of Zionism called revisionist Zionism, which really seeks to undo any socialist elements that are present within Zionism, seeing it as a barrier to the only goal, which is to create a Jewish state there at any expense and at any cost. And so this form of Zionism is typically more brutal, more ruthless in what it's willing to say, although it's certainly no more brutal or ruthless than what it's than the left, for example, is willing to do.
Tell me if I'm wrong. The way I've heard this explained is that you could say that the Zionist left had a political strategy of denying that there were Palestinian people there, whereas the Zionist right, in, for example, the form of Jabotinsky and his principles, was a very explicit acknowledgement that if Zionism is going to work, if this political project is going to work, then we're going to have to battle the people that live there.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that the Jewish left, the Zionist left, was very just reluctant to acknowledge the crises that they were generating within the Arab population. And the right was actually willing to take it on, but only willing to do so through force.
Would you say that the left's denial of the existence of the Palestinian people has carried through, has sustained, or would you say that it crumbled, for example, some in 1967 and then again in different moments?
Well, what I think you see happening time and time again is that the Israeli left, whether that's, you know, Ben Gurion, you know, in the earliest days of the state, to Ehud Barak and Shimon Peres today, are always stunned by any expressions of humanity that come from the Palestinian side. That they're never really fully understanding that the Palestinian people have their actual own aspirations and their own understanding of events and history that is just as powerful as the Israelis' understanding in history. And that what they've sought to do time and time again is to come up with policies and processes that will allow for the greatest level of exclusion of Arabs from Israeli life. And so whether that's just simply by denying that a labor problem exists in the, you know, the 10s and 20s, or in our present day and age, that there's a high degree of integration between Palestinians and Israelis in the region today by putting forward proposals such as the Oslo Accord, or today even the Geneva Accord, which is going to come with something like a two-state solution, which will allow Israelis to just be done with the Palestinian population as they understand it and not have to recognize them as equals in any way.
You've spoken a little bit to how you see people from the Israeli left trying to contend with these contradictions and the ways that moral and political decisions are manifesting for them in Israel now.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see the American Jewish left as trying to make sense of Israeli policy?
There's an American Jewish left that sees itself as a counterpart to the Israeli Jewish left. And so you have, for example, if you have peace now in Israel, you have supporters of peace now in the United States. And that is what's seen as the left. The same way that perhaps in a very inaccurate analogy, the Democrats or the liberal wing of the Democratic Party is seen as something of a left in the United States. I think to the listeners of KPFK, though, that definition of a left is not going to hold much water, and that the American Jewish left that does exist today is primarily anti-Zionist and recognizes that Zionism as a tool to emancipate the Jewish people, as to bring about a form of a Jewish renaissance, as a solution to the larger question of what should be the status of the Jews, has failed. And it's no longer a viable option or alternative. Largely because these inherent contradictions that emerged at the very beginning of Zionism have played themselves out in tremendous brutality in the creation of an apartheid-like system in Israel today, where you have one set of privileges for the Jews that are denied to the rest of the population of Palestinians.
Thank you.
This program is dedicated to the public domain. Please feel free to copy and share this program with others. It is available for free download at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. I would like to give a special thanks to the following people who helped make this program possible. Of course, Barry Trachtenberg for his time and dedication to the project. Also, Alan Minsky for suggesting and initiating the idea. The KPFK production staff for their engineering assistance. The members of the short-lived group called the Pondering Jews for their support. Jessica Lawless and J.J. Day for their support. And Dave Adelson of the L.A. Sound Posse for technical and editing assistance. Thanks very much for listening.